It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Law enforcement professionals and criminologists long have been challenged to arrive at a consensus over the most accurate ways to classify serial killers. With predators as diverse as the lesser-known William Zamasil to slick con artists such as Ted Bundy, one description certainly does not fit all when it comes to grouping the depraved minds that comprise America's most prolific murderers. Veteran criminal profiler Steve Daniels takes a detailed look into the behavioral intricacies that separate contract killers from sexual deviants, highly organized planners from low-functioning opportunists. Daniels advances the notion that current classification models fall short of the reality faced by law enforcement and prosecutors, offering an additional profiling tool in the battle against violent crime. The book that we're featuring this evening is Gazing into the Abyss, Serial Killer William Zamasil, The Victims, and Other Killers, with my special guest, former parole agent, author, and researcher, Steve Daniels. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Steve
Daniels. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. Let's start off first with your background in law enforcement. Could you give that to us for us?
Sure. I spent 27 years with the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. The last 9 years were as a high-risk parole agent, which means the people on my caseload were considered assaulted and dangerous, and virtually every one of them had at least one murder on their record. So
wow.
I got to know murderers very intimately. I was in their homes, at their workplaces, met their girlfriends, etc. I am the chairman of a cold case team for the Wisconsin Association of Homicide Investigators, and we just recently completed our 23rd successful case review.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Let's talk about William Zamasil, and you take us, as you do in your book, to August 1st, 1978, and you talk about a young man. We don't know who that is so far, but there's a young man promised to take his girlfriend and her kids shopping. So take us to August 1st, 1978. What essentially happens that day in 1978 with this man and these children? Take us from there, please.
Okay. Well, the unnamed man I will mention later on, but his girlfriend needed to go shopping, and he promised to take them to a local mall. But he spent much of the day drinking with a heavy consumption of alcohol, fell asleep on the couch. The young woman was getting extremely frustrated, so she woke him up, obviously still intoxicated, very ornery. The man had a history of being very volatile when drinking. They went to the cops department store, which is now closed, On the way, they were driving some back roads. He opened up a suitcase, pulled out a .38 caliber and a .45 caliber, ordered her to drive those back roads, and then proceeded to fire the guns out the passenger side window. Shell casings were flying all over the place. The woman hollered at him, imploring him to stop. He would not cease firing. Finally, he complied just as they arrived at the department store. She went in. He said that he would come back and get her. He failed to return, but a young woman named Mary Johnson, who worked in a mall, she was extremely vivacious, wonderful young lady. In matter of fact, she was getting ready to be married. She was planning her wedding, which is going to happen August 5th in a small town in Wisconsin. Anyway, Zamastil was waiting in a car and confronted Mary. She was a stranger to him. He had never met her before. And he forced her into a car around 5:15 p.m. when she had finished her shift. He was approached. He produced a handgun. He made Mary move to the passenger seat of the automobile. She was obviously being abducted, and I'm sure she realized that. Drove around for about 40 to 45 minutes, took her to this absolutely beautiful park in the southern part of the state, August W. Derleth Park. Beautiful, pristine, wooded area. He took Mary back into the woods, had the .45 handgun from his suitcase in the backseat of the car, forced Mary to walk down a path with him, told her to get undressed. Basically, obviously, you can hear her pleading, I'm sure she was, that she didn't care what you do, what he does to her, but she just wants to live. She's getting married. Well, told her to lie down. She complied. He unzipped his pants, forced sex on Mary, and then I'm sure she said, if you let me go, I won't tell anyone. No one knows what Mary said, but anyway, the gun was in plain sight. She was laying on her stomach. He straddled her, jacked around into the gun, and hearing the sound, Mary turned to look at him and then probably put her head down in defeat, and he killed her and got dressed and left. In the process, he left his wallet at the scene, and he thought he might go back and get it, but then thought, no, we cannot do this. I can't do this. So he called a deputy he had worked with in the past, said, I think I did something really wrong. Met the deputy at a store and took him into custody. The guy's name was William Zamastil. That was his last homicide in 1978. He had a very, very short killing career. But anyway, Mary Johnson was buried the day she was scheduled to be married, which makes it even twice as sad.
Yeah, incredible. Now, you write that there wasn't much to investigate in terms of this murder, since he had this confession and he went on to confess to this murder and then directed him to the park. So they had that much. But just looking at them, and of course, they would look at somebody like this who was capable of this and looking at him for other murders. So how does that work, and who is the person that's investigating and looking into the possibility of other murders?
All right. William obviously gets convicted of first-degree murder. He goes into the Wisconsin prison system, and so many of these killers, they absolutely love to talk. I mean, it's just unimaginable why you would tell anybody what you did. But anyway, he befriended another inmate who was in for murdering the stepdaughter of a police chief, and they became friends. Excuse me. They shared a cell, and Zamastil basically told this guy, well, they're looking at me for other murders. I killed a cop's son out west. I killed some people in California. Well, this guy was getting out, so he had no qualms about contacting the police. So we contacted the police. Rick Lewell was an investigator for the Wisconsin State Department of Justice, and he was a fantastic investigator. He was Homicide Investigator of the Year twice. He had some extremely famous cases, very famous in Wisconsin and probably beyond, and he retired. And the Department of Justice got a grant to bring some people back to review cold cases. So Rick Lewell comes back from retirement. This guy wants to talk to somebody. Rick Lowell goes to prison to see the anonymous tipster, and the guy says, well, yeah, I mean, he's told me about all these murders, and he even talked about Christine Rothschild, and we can talk about Christine a little later. She was a co-ed that was murdered on the Madison campus in 1968, but he even admitted to killing Christine Rothschild. So everybody's antenna went up. That's still a cold case. Rick Lowell meets with Zamostil on a number of occasions. They come to some plea agreements, and Zamostil says, you know, for some of the things that I want to do my time in Wisconsin, I don't want the death penalty, etc. He admits to killing Lisa Jo Scheiner, who was the daughter of an FBI agent, not the son of a cop, and two individuals who were hitchhiking in California, and he admitted to killing Christine Rothschild. Well, here we go. Rick Lowell, the grant runs out. He leaves. Another individual who's still an investigator comes into the scene, meets with Zamostil, and gets everything in writing except Christine Rothschild. He said, no, I'm not doing that anymore. I'm not going there. So Christine Rothschild is still a cold case, and the other murders are accounted for, and Zamostil goes to trial, and he's doing life in Wisconsin, has a detainer for a life sentence in Arizona in the federal prison system, and a detainer for two murders in California. There he is.
Let's talk about the murders, again, to take a look at his character and the M.O. and his signature at these murders. Lisa Jo Scheiner, May 29th, 1973. Can we talk about her? She resided in Tucson, Arizona.
Right. Lisa Jo was the daughter of an FBI agent, and she was going to an airport, to pick up her husband, who was coming home from leave in the military. So she goes to the airport. Her dad kind of says, well, maybe I should go and get him. No, I'll go get him. So she goes to pick him up and parks on the parking ramp, and no one hears from Lisa. And her husband comes home. He's got his duffel bag, and he's ready to vacation for a while. No Lisa. Calls the dad. Dad says, well, I saw her leave. She left, 2.5 hours ago. So he comes to the airport to find his daughter and finds her abandoned car on the parking ramp. Basically, all that comes of this whole thing is he abducted this woman, took her out into the desert, sexually assaulted her, killed her, gave her a shallow burial, which is just kind of a surface burial, and her body, her remains of her body, were found by two guys looking for Indian head arrows on the Army Reserve. So it's just another type of victim for Zamostil. He picks these women that are not high risk. They're not living high risk lifestyles. You know, Mary Johnson was leaving work, and Lisa Jo Scheiner was waiting to pick up her husband. I mean, you would think there was nothing that would put them in danger. But that's one of his MOs. He gets people that are not high risk, at least the ones that he's been convicted for.
He also admitted to the siblings, Jacqueline and her brother.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about those murders that he admitted to?
Jacqueline and her brother were, they were kind of wild children, and they were going to hitchhike to another part of California. Well, Mom says, I really wish you wouldn't do that, but okay, we're going to do it. So they get a ride to a gas station, and she calls her mom and says, you know what, this really nice guy is going to pick us up and give us a ride the rest of the way. Well, Malcolm was 17, Jacqueline was 18, they were coming from Canoga Park, California, and they wanted to see Jacqueline's boyfriend. So they were heading to Las Vegas. Well, the Bradshaw siblings left Pochillo and were intent on hitchhiking back to their home. They were seen at a gas station in Barstow, California. And then she called and said a white male with sandy-colored hair driving a small pickup with suitcases in the back picked them up to give them a ride. Well, obviously, they didn't make it. They were a little more high risk, two individuals hitchhiking. However, you would think with two of them, it'd be a little safer. But Zamostil sexually assaulted both of them. left their bodies, posed, if you will, shot them both, and then was arrested because when the cold case team came into business, he admitted to killing those two individuals too.
You say that there was some evidence that they were both sexually assaulted, which is very interesting and rare, I would say, also.
Well, Zamasil's sister said that he is bisexual and that he would, if he needed something, like a place to stay or, you know, a job or whatever it needed to be, he would have sex with males. So the raping of the young boy, the Bradshaw boy, is not out of character for him at all. He worked at a hotel in L.A., and he was probably living with a homosexual there because the guy had a room, and Zamasil didn't have any money to pay for a room. Mm-hmm. So, yes, there's evidence that he was bisexual.
You talk about, too, in one of the murders or more, I think two, where he stole the victim's car. So, again, not a very bright thing to do, but something he did do.
Well,
high risk as well.
Yes, and his early criminality, early on, before the murders came to be known, he was a car thief. So stealing cars was part of his pattern. And he also stole suitcases from the people that he killed. And... Mm-hmm. You know, left him in the back seat of a car, and that was, you know, one of the trophies or the tokens that linked him to the crimes. It was a suitcase from the Bradshaw girl.
Yeah. It was also interesting too that they went and looked and searched and found other evidence in the woods when they did look after this crime, didn't they?
With the Bradshaws or with Lisa?
In one of the cases.
Well, they only found Lisa's remains, but they found the bodies of the Bradshaws posed, semi-nude, and then there was some basic evidence. There was some footprints. Zamasil was always known to wear cowboy boots. There were footprints in the sand in the area that matched his when they did casting. So, you know, the guy is a very disorganized killer. I mean, I'm sure your listeners know what that term's all about. But he's just very disorganized. He leaves his wallet at one murder scene. You know, he steals cars. He steals tokens and suitcases and leaves his footprints in the sand. I mean, the guy's not real sharp. He's not the brightest. So... but he had a very short killing career. I mean, I think I mentioned that before, but if his first murder was Christine Rothschild in 1968, and the one he was captured for was Mary Johnson in 1978, that's only a 10-year killing career. That's pretty short.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, if he did kill Christine, and I believe he did, if he did kill Christine, he was probably... a teenager, 18, 17, and he was a chronic guy that ran away from home constantly, and he didn't do well in school. So across the street from the hall, the college hall, where Christine was found, was the University Hospital. And it was believed he spent some time at University Hospital before they tore it down. And Christine would walk every day on campus. And she was absolutely beautiful girl. Oh, she was a model, and she was gregarious. She had a lot of friends, but she would walk every day early, and then she'd stop and have a cigarette. Well, it's time she stopped at the hall where they found her body, and she was buried. Not buried. She was in the bushes. Posed, and Zamasil basically said that she was his first kill. And usually when you say, this is my first kill, you intimate that there's going to be a second and a third and a fourth, that there already wasn't one.
Sure.
So that led people to think that Zamasil certainly did kill Christine, and Rick Lewell, again, who we mentioned before, was part of that investigation, and he basically said he thought it was just a teenage inexperience with sex, kind of poking and prodding, and I know her gloves were found shoved in her throat, probably so she wouldn't scream, and then she was murdered and left posed behind the bushes. So, but anyway, he admitted to it. I mean, other people think there was another serial killer involved who was a doctor, a medical doctor on campus, and who wore camouflage to work. And he was almost like a specter. He would just appear when people were talking, and then he'd be gone. And Christine had said she felt someone was looking in her dorm windows and kind of stalking her. And by the way, that's one thing to look for on college campuses if you're having some issues, are dorm burglaries and dorm peeping Toms and that sort of thing. But Christine really felt she was being watched. And this guy was kind of trying to ingratiate himself with her. She was really leery of him. He may have seen her sitting outside smoking, and he knew some of her habits. He was just a really creepy guy. He had photos when he was in Africa. He had photos of a couple massacred families, massacred with machetes. And they believe that he may, in fact, have been the person that massacred the families. But he never admitted to killing Christine. But mm-hmm. the investigation, you know, obviously turned around because, you know, Zamistil said, well, I killed Christine Rothschild. Basically, he said, I killed a young woman named Chrissy on campus. Well, that was her.
You talk about that there was an extradition from California, or to California, pardon me, and there was a, you talk about the prosecution, the DA, dropping the ball. Can you explain in what way they dropped the ball in terms of this plea agreement?
Well, dropping the ball, what I meant was the guy that picked up where Rick Lowell left off didn't get the signed confession on Christine. So Zamistil got basically everything he wanted. He's doing his time in California. I mean, I'm sorry, in Wisconsin. He's got a life sentence, so he's not going to get out. He's not going to get the death penalty. He's going to be in federal prison in Arizona, and then there's a detainer after that for California. So the guy's never going to see the light of day. But he's in Wisconsin. That's what he wanted. And they never got a signed confession on Christine because the guy didn't push Zamistil on it. That's what I meant by dropping the ball.
Mm-hmm. Right. There was still, as a result of still of this confession that he made, and the details that he gave to police to corroborate those confessions, there were still other victims that were potentially he was suspected of. In that case, in that investigation and that assumption, what was done and what cases were investigated specifically?
Well, there was a reporter out there that in that area that wrote that the desert is the number one burial ground in the country, excuse me, for murdered victims. That it's better than some cemetery because you're never going to find them and there's no grave markings. But he believes that there were a number of victims attributed to Zamistil, some of them unnamed. You know, he got in a fight with a guy and the guy never appeared again. Nobody knows what the guy's name was. But the reporter thinks that there may be up to 20 or 30 victims. And like I mentioned, most of them unnamed. It's just, he was so transient. I mean, he was a vagabond, and he was living in trashy hotels, get a job where he'd get a job, spend a lot of time in bars, seedy bars. So you get in a fight, you meet somebody out on the street, you kill them, you dump them someplace, nobody even knows who did it or who the guy really is. So a lot of the victims for Zamistil go unnamed. Obviously, there's Mary and then Christine, we think, and then the other ones that we mentioned are the ones that are named, and, you know, that makes him a serial killer. He really is and was an enigma. I mean, the guy was 6'4", about 290 pounds, flew totally under the radar, totally. Matter of fact, when I started doing this book, I contacted some of the chroniclers of serial killers, the ones that keep databases and files and that sort of thing. Many of them never heard of Zamasil until I mentioned his name. So I missed this guy really, really flew low under the radar. And if it wouldn't have been for Mary Johnson and leaving his wallet there, he may still be out and still be killing.
He talked to the informant, the cellmate, and he said that there was mining shafts that he would put bodies down. And you write that he was a tow truck driver. You talked about the desert. He was a tow truck driver in the Mojave Desert.
Yes.
So he had a lot of potential, didn't he?
He had a lot of potential, and I would even wager, as being a tow truck driver, there might have been some civilians, some people broken down on the side of the road that he may have killed them too and dumped them down the tunnels, the caves. I mean, there is no counting how many victims he truly has except the ones that he was convicted for.
You talk
but
about
the guy,
sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I forgot what I was going to say.
you talk about a military man, given that he would assault someone. You talk about a military man that was heading home and pulled over to the side of the road and was bashed in the head with a rock and his vehicle stolen.
Yeah.
Just as an example of a potential crime that Zamasil could have easily perpetrated.
Yes, you're exactly right. Yep. You know, the guy, he's a chameleon. Often presents himself as a nice guy. He claims he has a criminal record in many states, which is obviously true if he had murders in other states. He used different kind of weapons. Most of his victims that we can tell, obviously convicted for, were women, but there was a man in there, the Bradshaw boy. There are some men attributed to him, unnamed. So his victim pool is not very select. It's victims of convenience. And how much more convenient can it be if you're driving a tow truck on the highway in the desert and somebody's pulled over? So, yeah. His prison record is pretty interesting, too. He's a bully. Some people say he's a snitch when it benefits him. He was a member of what was called the European Culture Club, which is euphemism for the Prison Motorcycle Brotherhood, which is a gang. And they had a banquet, and the PMBs got in the middle of the room and did a chant, and, you know, and their hand signs, and there were civilians there, family members coming to have a banquet with the European Culture Club. And they left. They were frightened. He was violent in prison. He told people, if you knew what I did, you'd run from me. He got in some fights. He banged a guy's head in the bar, in the cell. So, yeah, his prison record is not good. But he has a very volatile temper, obviously when he's drinking, but not when he's drinking, too. He's told people that he enjoyed the killing. So he's a hedonistic killer. If you go to Ron Holmes's profiles, he's a hedonistic killer. He enjoys killing. That's what it's all about for him. He says if you like to hunt, it's the thrill of the hunt. He abducted his victims in populated places, which made it risky for him. The guy actually, he loves to kill. That's as simple as it is. Doesn't even enjoy the hunt all that much. Just enjoys the killing. Always carried a knife. So he used different methods of killing. So he's a hard guy to peg. I mean, very disorganized, very hedonistic, and very, very mobile, almost a nomad.
Interesting. Let's use this as an opportunity, Steve, to stop for a second for these messages from our sponsor, which is Ritual. We deserve to know what we're putting in our bodies and why, especially when it comes to something we take every day. Ritual's clean, vegan-friendly multivitamin is formulated with high-quality nutrients in bioavailable forms your body can actually use. What you won't find, sugars, GMOs, major allergens, synthetic fillers, and artificial colorants, plus the fresh taste and delayed-release capsule design make taking your vitamins easy. I chose to take Ritual Essential for Men 50 Plus about 3 months ago. When it became available, now available for men and teens, I decided to try it because my wife Lisa had been taking Ritual Essential for women for over a year, and she was impressed with the results of taking Ritual daily. She felt that it made a significant difference in her health. I wanted to experience Ritual for myself. Their research into a bioavailable vitamin and mineral sources has sold me on Ritual. They are a superior multivitamin. A multivitamin should contain key nutrients and forms your body can actually use to help fill gaps in the diet. No shady extras. Ritual's delayed-release capsule design delivers high-quality nutrients, including vitamin D3, in just 2 daily pills. Your multivitamins are delivered to your door every month with free shipping always. You can start, snooze, or cancel your subscription anytime. And if you don't love Ritual within your first month, they will refund your first order. Get key nutrients without the BS. Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/murder to start your Ritual today. Now, Steve, we were talking about William Zamistil, his personal behavior, some of the incredible things that he said to the informant in prison, some of the fascinating details, unique MO and signature of this killer. But you talk about in this book as well a need for a new category of multiple murder, a new classification. Maybe you can explain the need for this new classification in your mind. And as you do, we will talk about, soon after, a case study that sort of explains this necessity in detail.
Well, I belong to a couple of serial murder websites on Facebook, and there is a lot of debate about are hired killers serial killers? Are gang members serial killers? Mm-hmm. I don't believe they are. There's 6 types of homicide. There's the single, the double, which is 2 victims in one place, the triple, 3 victims in one place, the spree, 2 or more victims in separate locations as a continuing act, mass murder, 4 or more victims in the one location. A hitman can do any of those. Okay, he can kill 4 people in one location. He can kill 2 people in one location. A gang executioner can do that. But a serial killer, the individual that I believe is very sexually driven, very sexual. Mm-hmm. The fantasies are so brazen and so bizarre and so hateful and mean-spirited that the act can never live up to the fantasy. That's why they keep killing. To get that fantasy, okay. So hitmen and gang executioners, et cetera, are not driven by fantasy, and they usually don't take trophies. It's a matter of convenience. It's a matter of economics. It's a matter of fulfilling the leader's wishes. We need a category for that. Now, you'll notice in the paper that I wrote, I don't have a name for it. I mean, I don't have a name for it. Compulsive economic killer, or, you know, I hope somebody comes up with a good name for it. But generally speaking, these types of killers, they can be, you know, member of a African-American street gang, they can be a member of a Caucasian motorcycle gang, an Asian gang, Mexican cartel. You know, it doesn't know any boundaries as far as ethnicity is concerned. But almost every one of those types of killings is for some type of expediency within the organization. Okay, you kill unproductive members, uncooperative drug dealers, snitches, people that talk to the police, informants, personal killings. I don't like this guy in the gang, so get rid of him. Okay, to me, that's not a serial killer. That is someone killing simply to fulfill the wishes of another individual. And there's no cooling, and the only cooling off period for these guys, if you want to call it that, is in between kills, before someone suggests or orders or tells them to kill again. So, like I said, a hitman or a gang executioner can be any one of the 5 types of murder. I just don't think he can be a serial killer.
You talk about also sort of the talk of people that have the potential. I know that the FBI has changed their definition to, instead of three murders and the cooling off period, to two. But there is talk, even among them, about the classification of people that certainly have demonstrated through their crimes the potential to be a serial killer. And you talk about the cases of the interrupted serial killer. So can you talk about that?
Sure. When you, for example, there's an individual who kidnaps a woman. This is hypothetical. Kidnaps a woman, keeps her, you know, tied up for 3 weeks, rapes her, kills her, and dumps her body. And then he's interrupted. The police investigate. They find him. He goes to prison. He goes to a mental health facility. His career as a serial killer is interrupted. But he still has all the earmarkings of a serial killer who would go on to do it again if he wasn't caught. And I believe that there are plenty of those individuals out there, quite a number of them from our state of Wisconsin. And Enzo Yacek, who is the with the Atypical Homicide Research Group, he goes so far as to say an attempted murder or just some of the things that you do as an individual, the researching you do on the website, the people you follow, you know, you can have that serial killer mindset, you know, habitual offender, habitual killer mindset without killing anybody. And there's a big debate about that. You know, how wide are we going to make these margins? You know, if you start talking about one killer instead of two, you know, where are we taking this? But I'm a firm believer that the interrupted serial killer is, he's out there, he's dangerous, and it's a good thing we got him off the streets, because the individuals that I talked to, they said that they would do it again in a blink.
You cite Lawrence Singleton, and you call him the epitome of an interrupted serial killer due to the voraciousness of his sexual desires. Again, just what
yes.
we were talking about.
Yes.
This is September 29, 1978. Tell us what he does with the hitchhiker Mary Vincent, who's 15 years old.
Yeah, she's hitchhiking. She's, like she said, she's 15 years old. She's in California. She thinks she's getting a ride from this guy that's a good Samaritan. He's kind of older. I'm not sure if that was Singleton's first attack, but he was pretty old then to just be starting. So he picks Mary up, takes her to a secluded spot, repeatedly raped her, and then to complete whatever his fantasy is telling him in his twisted brain is that he needs to cut her hands off. Okay, and not only does he cut her hands off about up to the elbow, he pitches her over a cliff, and she's naked, and she hits the ground, and she still survives. That's
incredible.
That's amazing to me. Yeah, and she climbs up and flags down a car. You know, this is a real good Samaritan. Here's this naked teenager, blood everywhere, no arms, no hands, and gives her a ride to the hospital. Mary gets hooks. You know, she gets
prosthetics. Yeah. We were talking about Mary Vincent, and she had prosthetic arms by the time that he was convicted or arrested for this crime.
She got the prosthetic arms very shortly after. He was arrested. I believe when he went to trial, she already had the prosthetic arms. But he got 8 years, and no one wanted him on parole. So he finished his sentence in kind of like a mobile home on the grounds of San Quentin until he discharged from parole. And when you discharge from parole, it means you don't have an agent. You don't report to anybody. You've completed your entire sentence, okay? So he moves to Florida and gets involved in some, I don't know, low-level theft and that kind of stuff. But one day, a neighbor hears a phone the police. She heard a scream, 1997, that Singleton was assaulting a woman in his apartment. The police go to the door. Singleton is standing there with a knife in his hand, covered in blood, and on the floor was Roxanne Haynes, who'd been stabbed multiple times in a murderous frenzy. So his career was interrupted with Mary Vincent. No more serial murder for him until he gets out and he starts again. I mean, that is the epitome of an interrupted serial killer.
Yeah, absolutely. You talk about next a killer named John Weber.
Yes.
And his trial was in the spring of 89. You say that he looked like a crazed werewolf and wore a fur mask. Can you talk about this case?
I spent about 12 to 16 hours interviewing John. He's a very interesting young man, not so young anymore, but he looked like a werewolf, and his defense attorney wanted him to look like that because they were pushing a not guilty by reason of insanity defense. So he came to court looking like he was crazed. Anyway, he picked up his sister-in-law, Carla, took her for a ride on November 11th of 1986, and she didn't tell anybody who she was going with. So she never returned home. He murdered her, left her, buried her partially on a vacant lot that was near the family's property. He made an audio tape of that, of what he did to Mary. To Carla. It was absolutely vile, disgusting, filthy. No person in their mind should have to listen to that, and I think the jury did, and I'm sure they were just traumatized by what they heard. But he tortured her and did many things to her, cut off some portions of her body, cannibalized her, etc. Okay. He makes this tape to scare his wife because he's going to kill his wife. So he takes his wife out and sexually assaults her, plays the tape for her, and beats her with a shovel, brings her to the hospital, and says some men abducted her while she was out in the woods, and stuck to that story for quite a while until they figured, wait a minute, John, come on. Why don't we sit down and talk about this? And finally he said, you're right, I did it. I tried to kill her. They tried to put him with some other crimes. There was somebody missing in State Fair in Milwaukee, and they thought they saw Weber around that area at the time. He was in the military, and they tried to see if there were some murders when he was in the military. I'm not sure what became of that investigation. But when I interviewed John, he would tell me that, I would say, John, if you ever get out on parole, what does your agent need to know about you? And he said, well, number one, do not ever, ever let me near high school sporting events where they're cheerleaders. I can't be in that kind of company because somebody's going to get hurt. Wow. His fantasy life was so intense, that he would have to leave his workstation multiple times a day to go to the men's room to masturbate. Wesley Dodd, the child killer, said that he could think of nothing else. He said, it's amazing I could hold a job, because all I thought about was killing kids. Well, that's how John Weber was. All he could think about was his fantasies, and they overtook him. And I believe he still has them. They may be less, but they're certainly not gone. I think maybe medication helps. I don't know. But one day when I was wrapping up the interview, he had to go to eat. He said, can I tell you something? Sure, of course you can. He said, when I was 12 years old, I would dream about eating my neighbor. He said, that's not normal, is it? I said, well, John, no, it's actually not normal. So as far as I'm concerned, that guy is definitely an interrupted serial killer and would still be killing today if he wasn't incarcerated for the rest of his life. So this thought process, it's cyclical. It never goes away. The cooling off period is different lengths of time for different individuals, but once that cooling off period is done, you got to kill again. So, and John would have killed again. So it's kind of interesting. His social worker in the prison, I thought, was very inappropriate. He went to the town where John was from, Phillips, Wisconsin, and purchased a Phillips, Wisconsin sweatshirt to wear, and ate at the diners that John ate at. And I thought that was quite inappropriate. And sure. I was interviewing John, and we were continuing interviewing, and the social worker convinced John that I was writing a book about him. Well, at the time, I had no intentions of writing a book about him. But John sent me a letter saying, I don't want to talk to you anymore. We're done. Our conversations are over. So, you know, this just happened to enter into my book when we're talking about interrupted serial killers. But John was evil. He was evil on the streets. So
you talk about the, Lawrence Singleton was sentenced to a relatively light sentence, I guess, given just due to the difficulties at trial to prosecute him and assign him a more serious sentence. But he was out in 8 years. And you talk about being a high-profile parole officer. Was there not any mandatory parole that he was due after his incarceration? And what do you have to say about somebody that obviously somebody could see the potential? And, of course, with this woman on the floor, Roxanne Hayes, certainly proved what he was capable of again.
Well, as I mentioned, with Singleton, he could not leave the prison grounds. So he got 14 years, but I did 8. So he had probably, 5 more years possibly on parole supervision, maybe 4, depending if he had any good time coming. So he had to stay on the grounds of San Quentin in a mobile home. If he went anywhere, a correctional officer would have to take him. So he stayed there until he did discharge. And as I mentioned, discharge means that you have completed your entire sentence. You don't report to anybody. You don't have an agent. You don't do any urine screens, drug tests. You do nothing. You're a free man. And that's what Singleton did. So he wandered around the country. God knows what he did. And ended up doing some petty crimes in Florida. And then ended up murdering Roxanne Hayes. So obviously the fantasies and the thrill didn't go away with him either.
Mm-hmm. You cite go ahead, sorry.
I was going to say John has a life sentence, and there is no mandatory release with a life sentence, okay?
Mm-hmm.
There's a time when you get to see the parole board after so many years, but there's no mandatory release, which means they have to let you out, and then you finish your sentence on parole. So John is never going to get out. I mean, he's going to die in prison, as are many of these individuals. Simply because, A, it was first-degree intentional homicide. Plus, they tacked on so many other things with him, sexual assault, kidnapping, and that. I think he's got life plus 980 years. So no one has to worry about John getting out and killing anybody anymore. And that's where people say, why don't they kill in prison? I mean, what's different? Well, I'll tell you what I believe is different in prison. Their victim pool isn't there. Okay, there's no children for Wesley Dodd to kill. There's no young women for John Weber to kill. There's no hitchhikers for Zamasdil to kill. Their victim pool is gone. It's totally gone, which takes them a little bit out of the game. Plus, it's probably the healthiest they've been in their adult life. When Richard Ramirez was killing in his final frenzy, he was living on Coca-Cola, Twinkies, and cigarettes and cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
Henry Lucas was living on cigarettes, marijuana, coffee and sugar, and junk food. So do I think that influences some of the actions? Yes. And their health is good in prison. They get 3 squares. It's probably the best they've slept in years. Yes, there's drugs available, but everybody doesn't take them. So they don't kill in prison because they're high profile also, and I think correctional officers treat them different. They have a little bit of fame, a little bit of celebrity status to them. So you see some serial killers kill in prison, but not very many of them. So,
yeah, and it's also not the same circumstance that they were excited about in their murderous career as well. And very, very difficult to get away with murder in prison. Very much more difficult. So,
correct.
Different dynamics and a completely different type of murder for these kind of killers.
There was a really interesting guy. Do we have time?
Sure.
For one more. Oh, his name is Joe Clark. He's from Wisconsin. Joe, yeah. Just a strange individual. He abducted. By the way, just as an aside, I think kidnapping and abduction are two different things. I think when you right. kidnap someone, there is talk of a ransom, and then you'll get the mm-hmm. person back. When you abduct someone, I think it's for very nefarious purposes, murder, sexual assault, that sort of thing. So I try to use abduct whenever I can, but sometimes I slip. Anyway, police found a screen cut for Christopher Steiner's bedroom and muddy footprints. He was found about a week later, his body lying over a fallen tree in a sandbar. No noted injuries that they could find, but they were certain it was murder. Okay? On July 29th, I think it was, in 1995, another youth went missing. He found himself being carried and dragged and hoisted and ordered to run through the backwoods. And he was still half asleep, so he really didn't even know what was going on. Joe Clark took his victim to an old, just filthy, abandoned hovel. And he loved, one of his fantasies was to hear bones break. He loved to grab and twist and yank and manipulate until an ankle broke, and then he went for the leg. Just a sexual fantasy for the perpetrator. And then he would bind the wounds, kind of makeshift, with sock-like casts. And that's the other part of his fantasy. He loved white athletic socks, and he loved the smell of them. The victim got away and called 911, and they did exhumed the body and found out, you know what, wait a minute here, there's way too many similarities. So Clark got 100 years in prison.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I just think a teenager, who likes to hear the bones break and snap and likes athletic socks and to smell them, those are pretty bizarre fantasies.
When you talk about the youth, and you cite another couple dramatic cases where young serial killers started at a young age, and then we get back to Christine Rothschild, and the idea that Zamistil could have done this at 15 years of age. What was about the crime itself that indicated, for lack of a better term, a lack of sophistication as a killer with Christine?
Well, she was dumped behind some bushes at Sterling Hall. And if I can just mention this, Sterling Hall came to fame at the University of Wisconsin in the early 1970s, a ragtag bunch of domestic terrorists, which we didn't call them back then, blew up Sterling Hall. It was a math research center for the Army, so they blew it up, and there was an individual, a researcher in there, and he died as a result of that explosion. But that's the same hall that Christine's body was found, behind the bushes. And basically, the gloves, it was very unsophisticated, really unsophisticated. Like, there was a lot of grabbing and tearing of clothes, and like I said, the gloves were shoved down her mouth to probably keep her from screaming. There was no completed sexual assault that I remember from her, and her clothes were ripped, and her raincoat was inside out. I mean, to me, that screams of Zamistil, very unsophisticated, and that lack of sophistication followed him through his adult killing career. It took a guy to come, and he was unlocking the door at Sterling Hall, and he looked in the bushes, and he thought it was a mannequin. And he looks, and there's Christine, dirty, muddy, wet. It was raining, and, you know, like Rick Lewell said, he just thought this was something that went really wrong, and a lot of sexual innuendo, but nothing completed, and, you know, nothing, well, just unsophisticated.
You use a term in this book, maybe I'm mispronouncing it, bifurcated or bifurcated murder.
Bifurcated.
Can you explain that?
I will. Some researchers and professionals are trying to get rid of the word spree killing because they believe it really is so hard to define. I don't think it is, but okay. So, some people call it serial murder at warp speed. Some people call it a mobile mass murder. So what the bifurcated means in a lot of spree killings is the killing starts maybe in a private place at home, you kill your mom and your dad. And then you take it to someplace else and you kill three other people. Well, that's a bifurcated mass murder. It happens in two places. And they're trying to get rid of the term spree killer. I quite frankly like the term spree killer, and I think it hits the nail on the head, but, you know, that's above my pay range, so.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some good work being done out there, some really good work in the area. Some new information is going to be coming out. Laura Brand is a young woman who has interviewed 50 serial killers, and she is coming out with a study on that she designed herself. Plus, she's doing a documentary and a book on the toolbox killers, Bittiger and Norris.
Oh, yeah.
You're familiar with them?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay. And Enzo Jacek is doing some great work with the Atypical Homicide Research Group, Tom Hargrove, Murder Accountability Project. So there's some new ideas coming. And I think people that are into true crime will really kind of get an idea that this is not a stagnant subject. We're finding new killers every day, and we're finding new ideas about them, and I think they'll be pleased.
Interesting. Yes, yeah, so you talked about Enzo Jacek, the serial killer expert and founder of the Serial Homicide Expertise and Information Sharing Collaborative.
Yes.
And he talks about potential killers. We had mentioned this, fledging or budding killers, and homicidal ideation.
Yeah.
Just the process of thinking about murder, and we talked about some of those people. In the terms of serial killers and sort of interest in serial killers, I would say, or attention to, where does William Zamistil stand in terms of people looking at serial killers? How do they look at him? I know he's not as well known, and you cite a bunch of other not so well known Wisconsin serial killers, but you have decided to feature William Zamistil. What do others, as a result, feel about William Zamistil and his status as a serial killer?
On a scale of 0 to 10, 2. He is so unknown, refuses to talk. So everything is, you know, research, and nobody gets to meet him face-to-face because I've sent him letters, and he doesn't even respond to them. I sent his family letters. They don't respond. So he's not as famous as other Wisconsin ones. I mean, you mentioned that yourself. Jeffrey Dahmer and Ed Gein and, you know, Edward Edwards, all those individuals, mm-hmm. they're much more famous than Jeffrey Dahmer, and they probably will. And if people don't read my book, and that's up to them, they'll never know who William Zamistil is because he's not out in the mm-hmm. forefront.
Yes. Well, he's absolutely a fascinating serial killer. And what's interesting, too, is that you cite a bunch of other ones and provide the details of these serial killer in their cases. And quite shocking to realize in Wisconsin alone, this many infamous serial killers that we know of, when you mentioned
yeah.
already, but all of these other ones that certainly warrant notice by the true crime audience and obviously by investigators, and that's why they were convicted of multiple murder in many cases in Wisconsin.
Yes. Yes, there's some very famous ones. And, you know, I'm not proud of that, but there are some very famous ones. So, and there's some famous interrupted serial killers, too, you know, that I mentioned in the book. So, yeah. You said you've done 500 interviews?
This is what will be about 590 interviews over an 11-year span of time. On
murder. Yeah,
yes.
On most of it's serial killers?
I would say not. I don't know about most, because there's certainly, it's the most shocking killer, so it's certainly anybody that, and many of these killers are one-off killers, maybe convicted of one or two. They certainly aren't classified as serial killers, but in terms of shocking killers, they certainly make the grade. So, yeah, so
yeah.
This will be about 590 episodes talking about gazing into the abyss. Steve, for those people that might want to take a look at this work and other work, I know you have a couple other books as well, or one on the way and another book. So tell us about where we might find Gazing into the Abyss and your other work.
Well, Gazing into the Abyss is from Amazon or Barnes & Noble. The other book is called Harry, A Study of Teenage Mass Murderers. This is a case in 1963 where a teenager murdered his whole family, probably the first progeny mass murder in recorded history in Wisconsin. It happened in Green Bay, in a little side street. My father was the lead investigator on the case. And Harry has never talked to anyone either. Absolutely. And he's been institutionalized since the day after the killings. He was arrested, went to jail, couldn't defend himself in court or couldn't assist in his defense, went to the state mental health facility till he could aid in his defense, came back to the jail, was convicted, and went to prison, and he's been there ever since. So he's been there since 1963. And I talk about a couple other things in the book, school shooters and some other mass murders in Wisconsin that I call Harry's legacy that came after him. The book I'm working on now is two parts. It's a spree killing in the city of Wausau where a young detective was murdered along with five other people. And the second part of the book is a sniper in a little county in northern Wisconsin where he shot and killed three teenagers that were swimming in a river. And it was kind of militaristic. So that's the next book. I don't even have a title for it yet.
Incredible. Well, we'll look forward to talking to you about both of those books, hopefully in the very, very near future. I want to thank you so much, Steve Daniels, for coming on and talking about Gazing into the Abyss, Serial Killer William Zamistil, The Victims, and Other Killers. Thank you so much for this interview, and you have a great evening. Thank you, and good night.
Thanks for having me. Bye.
Thank you. Good night.